it's John Dennis on Thursday, the 22nd of January. Today, as sterling weakens against the dollar, a row erupts over the lifting of the ban on the controversial practice of short selling.
The government is actually quite angry with the regulators for having gone ahead with this ban without lifting this ban without more consultation.
As America's new president halts military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay, historian Simon Sharma considers Barack Obama's inaugural speech.
You've got the whole arc, really, of American history from its absolute beginnings to now, and that was the kind of conceptual panorama that he is really astonishingly good at.
And some of our MPs could face political difficulties. They've lost their fight to keep details of their expenses a secret.
Basically, it was a political own goal.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news headlines and the papers.
In Washington, President Obama has circulated a draft executive order for the closure of the Guantanamo Bay prison camp within a year. Judges at the camp agreed to suspend all military trials going on there. Other executive orders to control the handling of terror suspects and their interrogation are said to be in preparation. In the meantime, the new president has taken his oath of office again. After the stumble at the public inauguration by both the Chief Justice and the President, they decided to go through the procedure again for the sake of legal certainty. Only members of the White House staff were present. And afterwards, President Obama joked that it was so much fun, they decided to do it again, but very slowly. The United Nations Security Council's call for the temporary ceasefire between Israel and Gaza to be made permanent and calls on UN states to provide guarantees to reopen all border crossings but prevent arms smuggling. The Secretary-General, who's just returned from visiting Gaza, said it depended on Egypt and the Arab League, as well as world leaders, to ensure those guarantees. The major Asian economies are showing more signs of slowdown. China and South Korea have announced sharp falls in growth, though neither is yet in actual recession. Japan's reported its exports have slumped by a third. China's already introduced an economic stimulus package and lowered taxes. Also on the economy, the head of Britain's Financial Services Authority said the regulatory system needed changing. In a speech in London, Lord Turner accepted that his authority had made mistakes in monitoring Northern Rock. He also said regulators, banks and finance ministers were all to blame for not seeing that the world financial system was out of control, which led to the present crisis. We'll have more on the economy shortly. A whirlwind hits Washington, reads the Guardian's front page banner headline over a picture of Barack Obama on the phone to world leaders at his new desk. It says his new foreign policy includes an offer of negotiations with Iran. Several other papers show a similar picture, and the Times says that he started a peace drive, placing the Middle East at the forefront. It also reports he's expected to name George Mitchell, who brokered peace in Northern Ireland, as his Middle East envoy. The tabloids prefer pictures of the new presidential couple dancing the night away on Inauguration Day. How they dance their way through 10 balls in one night, according to the Mail, groove Obama is the way that the Sun puts it. Other stories include the row between the Chancellor and the FSA and the Guardian. The Express and the Mail are furious that Northern Rock Bank, even though it's to be nationalised to save it from collapse, is still paying bonuses to its staff. Failed bank staff share £9 million payday, shouts the Mail. What planet are they on, groans the Express. In the sports pages, most reporters are still chasing who Manchester City might now try to buy with their millions. The Sun and the Mail think it's Chelsea's Didier Drogba, the Chelsea misfit, as the Sun calls him. The Times and the Independent think it's Thierry Henry, formerly of Arsenal, now at Barcelona. The Guardian comments that Henry was just one of the big names City tried for but missed during this brief winter transfer window. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The pound is facing increasing pressure as the state of Britain's public finances worsen. Yesterday, sterling fell to its weakest level against the dollar since September 1985. Well, at least part of that plunge in the value of the pound can be put down to short selling. That's when traders borrow shares, sell them in the expectation that their price will fall, then buy them back at a lower price before returning them and pocketing the difference. Our head of business, Dan Roberts, explains how bad the situation is for sterling.
Sterling's fallen further against the euro quite recently. At Christmas, it nearly reached parity, but the big worry this week is steep falls against the dollar. And the worry really is about whether we as a country are going to have to assume all of the liabilities of the banking sector if lots of the banks get nationalised. If that happens, then all of the uncertainty surrounding the banks suddenly becomes an uncertainty surrounding the country. And that's the main reason behind the weakness in sterling.
How bad will it get? I mean, could we see pound-dollar parity?
Well, one trader this morning actually said they were selling sterling because they thought it would get to dollar sterling parity, which sort of prompts the sort of slightly surreal prospect of having sterling, euro and the dollar all roughly worth the same amount. I think personally we're a long way from that yet. We're a lot closer to euro parity than we are to dollar parity. But it is indicative of the kind of scaremongering, fear, paranoia that's out there in the market this week.
And what's the role of short selling in all this?
Well, it's a bit of a mystery. The initial feeling was that the return of short selling, which had previously been banned, hadn't played a big role in the collapse of bank shares this week. We actually get to see how much short selling there is now because firms have to disclose it under the new rules, and there hasn't been any sizable positions. Having said all of that, the coincidence is startling that the within a day of the ban being lifted on Friday, we've had the biggest collapse in UK share prices, bank share prices, since the dark days of the autumn. And actually, when the US lifted its ban on short selling, within a day or two, they had a big run on Citigroup. So the anecdotal evidence suggests that there is a connection here. And we think the government is actually quite angry with the regulators for having gone ahead with this ban without lifting this ban without more consultation.
Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, said on Tuesday that the bank was preparing for quantitative easing. Can you explain what that is and what the significance of it is?
Yeah, it's one of those phrases that fills people with dread, and it's actually fairly straightforward. It's a version of printing money. It's a version of sort of pumping new money into the system. The way the bank is likely to do it is by buying up company loans. So using the bond market as a way of pumping more liquidity into and reinflating the economy. It's something that central banks do extremely rarely. And the sight of Mervyn King standing up this week and saying that he's preparing to do it has been another factor in why sterling has been so weak, because it's a sign of just how desperate things are.
Will the British government be able to say to its critics, look, the US government's doing what we're doing, other European governments are doing what we're doing, we must be doing the right thing in all this?
Yeah, I think they can. And that's one of the few silver linings in all this, is that pretty much everybody's in the same boat. It's harder to see a speculative attack on a currency when all the other currencies are in dire straits too. And that's some cause for reassurance during this. I don't think anybody's really blaming the government for all this. I think everybody is sort of, you know, just deeply, deeply worried about the market and what to do about it.
And meanwhile, Dan, yesterday the level of unemployment reached 1.92 million. That's the highest it's been since 1999, but not quite as bad as some have predicted.
No, I think it's a taste of things to come. These are figures for the end of last year, and actually they chime with some of the retail numbers we had out of the high street for that same period, sort of November, December time, that also weren't quite as bad as people feared. And it does seem a little bit that firms were holding back from making too big a redundancies in the run-up to Christmas. Shoppers were still trying to spend. My suspicion is that was a temporary kind of calm before the storm, and we're already seeing some quite big job cuts being announced by companies in the last few weeks. So I expect the next set of numbers to be a lot higher than that.
Dan Roberts, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/business. Also on The Guardian's website, a behavioural economist has produced research showing that a disproportionately high number of Britons died on the Titanic because they queued politely for the lifeboats while others elbowed their way on. Ada Edamerian looks at the psychology of queuing at guardian.co.uk/G2. There's an interview with the film director Ron Howard by Stuart Jeffries at guardian.co.uk/film. And you can follow the Australian Open live, Andy Murray's second round game from 10 a.m, and the rest of the day's action with our live scoreboard at guardian.co.uk/sport. America's new president, Barack Obama, has suspended military trials of terrorist suspects at Guantanamo Bay for 120 days. He says it's in the interests of justice. But our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia, says this must be only a first step. What happens next will be a key test of Obama's presidency.
They are considering closing Guantanamo, and they will move in that direction very soon. Now, that will take a long time, but this is something that could be done instantly. And obviously, as these military commissions go forward, they create more problems for the Obama administration, who don't believe they're legitimate courts of law anyway. So if for him to let them carry on would be creating more problems for him down the line. So it was really a question of being in a hole and stopping digging, really. It was something that could be done immediately to limit the size of the problem that is already significant on his entry.
What could America do with the 245 or so inmates of Guantanamo Bay?
Well, this is the real problem facing the new Obama administration. The Bush administration was trying to unload them as fast as it could in the last year, year and a half of its existence, and managed to unload 500 of them on their countries of origin, other countries who are willing to take them in. They have, in a way, got rid of the easy cases. Now, the 250 pose a serious problem. It may be in Portugal and Germany, for example, and in Europe, have offered to take more of them as a gesture of goodwill to the incoming administration. But even if Europe takes in a significant number, that will still leave maybe 100, 200 perhaps, who will pose a problem to the new administration, because if they are taken to trial in the US, it may be that there's not enough evidence that will stand up in a court of law, particularly as many of them may have been tortured or at least subject to harsh, illegal interrogation, and that will taint that evidence. So you may have these people where they are strongly suspected of being, or may be known that they're senior al-Qaeda leaders, but they can't be convicted in the court of law. What do you do then? This is the real problem facing Obama now.
In general foreign policy terms, Julian, what evidence was there of fresh thinking in Obama's inaugural speech that set him apart from the Bush era?
Well, I thought that the foreign policy part of the speech was a little less radical than the domestic half. We didn't really break new ground. I mean, the phrase that people are talking about is, "We will extend our hand if you will unclench your fist." But that's a kind of conditionality that's always been there. If you're a nicer government, then we'll do more business with you. And that's the offer to Syria and Iran. The real problem facing the Obama administration is what to do with those fists that remain clenched. How do you get them to unclench their fists? Do you engage? Do you shake their hands as a way of unclenching the fist? That's the real problem, and he didn't address it.
How quickly do you think we'll hear something from the Obama administration on Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, Obama promised that he would say something. He had a lot to say, and that he was holding himself in while he was still president-elect. Now he comes to office. The urgency has declined to a great extent because there's been a withdrawal. So the urgency isn't there. The humanitarian emergency isn't quite as pressing as it was. But nevertheless, he obviously prepared something to say on the Israel-Palestinian question, particularly about Gaza. And I would imagine that because the situation is still very precarious, that they will come up with something in the next few days, because they had promised to say something on day one.
Julian Borgia. Well, now that the dream has become a reality and Barack Obama is the United States' 44th president, we're still left with a sense that his inauguration was an extraordinary moment to have witnessed. But was it also an extraordinary speech? The historian Simon Sharma.
Well, I think it was, it was a good, not great speech. It depends really whether one's talking aesthetically. And I suppose, it was very aggressively not into lofty flights of prose poetry. But that was precisely because the mood was so dark. I think the target, possibly even subconsciously in his mind, was not so much George Bush, although there was a lot of talk about needing to restore America from what had been done over the past few years. But the real talk, I think, was Ronald Reagan. This was about as much of a not mourning in America speech as you could imagine. There was a sort of sense of philosophical austerity about it that did not want to sugar the pill, did not want to indulge in fake sunshine. It may be that, the problem with the speech, and it was a problem, I think, was that he overcorrected so much. It wasn't, I didn't care at all about it not sounding like JFK or Abraham Lincoln in terms of the cadences and the fanciness of the prose. I thought it was completely right for the moment to really lower the voltage on flights of rhetoric. What I think he could have done was just love up the audience a bit more.
What did you think of the way Obama invoked America's history to inspire future courage?
Yeah, well, I've made a series that presupposes that's a good thing to do. So, of course, that was fantastic. It was odd that he didn't make more of, you know, Martin Luther King wasn't even mentioned. I know he's done it a million times, and he did it at the public concert. But it was odd that he didn't allow the African-Americans and many other Americans just to relish a little more than one cursory reference to what he called the dream that began on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and ended here. No, he does, you know, for him, America is history. I mean, he personifies it. It's in his wiring. It was fantastic, I thought, that he ended with Washington. I mean, that was a huge surprise, and for those in the know, it was very movingly powerful, because Washington was the president, of course, who freed his slaves on his death. He had more of a stricken conscience about it than did Jefferson. And also, Washington is so damn white, you know, really, I thought to myself. But it was a wintry image again. You can either say, as I do on the whole, that there was a brilliant twinning together of the absolutely bloody freezing temperature, the kind of winter of our discontent moment which America's going through, and Washington being, you know, stuck on the ice floes of the Delaware River, and the soldiers shivering at Valley Forge. I mean, I don't know whose idea that was, but that was rather brilliant. Washington wasn't one for cuddling the audience particularly, either, I have to say, in the Lincoln way. So it was an amazing, what was brilliant about that, actually, was you've got the whole arc, really, of American history from its absolute beginnings, indeed before its beginnings, you know, in the Revolutionary War, to now. And that was the kind of conceptual panorama that he is really astonishingly good at. So I found that very moving and very powerful and extremely unexpected. And I don't know how the crowd... I tell you, I talked to a lot of people in the crowd. People loved it. The more regular the folks you talk to, not to be snooty about it myself and using that phrase, the more awestruck they were. I asked them a lot about it. They didn't feel they needed a bit of loving up or joke or something. They were really folded into the solemnity of the occasion.
Simon Sharma. My name's John Dennis. Coming up on Guardian Daily, military service veterans who were exposed to radiation during nuclear tests at the height of the Cold War take their fight for compensation to the High Court.
For about 5 seconds, we could see every bone in our finger from the flash that had passed through us.
But first, details of MPs' expenses will soon be made public. A parliamentary order was to have exempted MPs' expenses from the Freedom of Information Act, but that depended on a deal between Gordon Brown and David Cameron to keep them secret. And it emerged yesterday during Prime Minister's questions that agreement between Brown and Cameron had collapsed.
There will be enhanced audit by the National Audit Office. We will put these to the House on a free vote. We had thought we had agreements on the implications of the Freedom of Information Act as part of this wider package. Recently, that support that we believed we had from the main opposition party was withdrawn. So on this particular matter, I believe all party support is important, and we will continue to consult on that matter.
Well, the government's U-turn represents a major victory for Freedom of Information campaigners, and our Westminster correspondent, David Henke, is rubbing his hands with glee.
Absolutely, because I actually think they were daft, politically inept, stupid, and frankly, a sort of really with no political nous to introduce these regulations, because for Joe Public, it basically looked they all had their snouts in the trough, they all wanted to cover everything up, and it's not true because a lot of them are quite honest and don't do this, but it basically was a political own goal, this whole measure, because it made MPs separate from every other public official, chief constables, councillors, chief executives, civil servants, you name it, have to produce details of expenses if there's an FOI request. MPs were going to be exempt.
But as you said earlier, there is clearly potential now for embarrassment among our politicians.
Well, enormous embarrassment. I mean, already in a very limited disclosure that only affected 14 MPs, it threw up information like Margaret Beckett spent over £1,900 on having a pergola and lots of exotic plants put in her Derbyshire constituency home garden, and that raised eyebrows. And Barbara Follett, who is the wife of the famous millionaire author Ken Follett, claimed £1,600 to have her windows cleaned of her London home, and that has come out already. And there have been previous disclosures that have come out through inquiries by the Parliamentary Standards Officer, like the Wintertons, and Nicholas Winterton and his wife were claiming £21,000 a year rent from a trust they had set up on a flat so their children would benefit, and this was actually ruled out of all order by the Commission.
David Henke. £25,000 members of the armed forces from the UK, Australia and New Zealand were stationed near nuclear test sites in the South Pacific and Australia in the 1950s. The veterans say that the Ministry of Defence should be liable for the thousands of servicemen who are exposed to dangerous levels of radiation. The MOD denies liability. If it loses, it could have to pay millions of pounds in compensation. Some of the veterans spoke to The Guardian's Peter Walker outside the High Court.
My name is Peter Halliwell. I'm 71 and I come from Basingstoke. And I served with the Royal Air Force on Christmas Island.
Could you describe the events that led up to you being at the nuclear test site?
Well, going to Christmas Island, we weren't told where we were going. We just shipped out to Christmas Island, mostly to enjoy ourselves till we realised that we were guinea pigs really out there. On the day of the operation that was going on, we were told to roll the side of our tents up, open all doors, windows, so the blast could actually go through them. Those that didn't do that, the tents were knocked down and blown to the ground. Later on, we had to all assemble for the operation that was going on. While we were there, we had to face the bomb until the mushroom went up into the air. And then we were told to turn our backs to the blast. And after turning our backs to the blast, we had a KD uniform on, plus a white boiler suit, gauntlets on our hands, and we had to sit with our hands over our eyes with the gauntlets on. And for about 5 seconds, we could see every bone in our finger from the flash that had passed through us.
Could you feel the force of the blast on yourself?
Oh, very much so, yes. I mean, it's like when the blast came, it was like lifting the island up off the ground and taking it back down again. It's quite an enforcement. I mean, it was only about 50 miles away from us anyway.
Did your superior officers describe in advance what would be going on and why you were there?
Not a thing, not until the actual day of the operation. When we got there, it was like a big holiday to start with, and everybody was enjoying themselves. And it was, when the operation came, we were told all what to do, one thing or another, but no way did we expect that we was out there for H-bomb testing.
Did you fear afterwards you might have been exposed to dangerous levels of radiation?
Not at the time. It was until a few years later, because when I came back from there, back of my head was all crusted, as if it had been burnt. I suffered very bad boils and one thing or another when I came back from there. And it took a few years for myself to get right from there. But having said that, a lot of people a lot worse off than where we were, sort of thing.
George Armstrong, Royal Engineers, 38 Corps Engineer Regiment, Christmas Island, 1958. It felt as though you were being passed backwards through an oven when it first ignited. And then the blast was where trees were blown over, coconuts blasted off the tree.
I'm Trevor Michael Butler. I'm from Hull. I was stationed with 38 Engineer Regiment, Royal Engineers. When the heat came on my back, it felt as if all the blood was bubbling in your veins. And just recently, I was told we're actually getting microwaves. That's how you microwave waves. It bubbles the juices from the inside. I saw 2 H-bombs and 3 atom bombs. I was approximately 7 miles from the three atom bomb explosions, and the heat, the similar recurs of the heat, flash heat blasts, but not as savage.
Were you given any warnings about the radiation or the possible impact?
No. We're just there, what they told us, we're just there as support Royal Engineers, Army Engineers, building roads, runways, radio masts, shelters for the equipment, just a support engineer regiment. The snag we found was to move the dropping drone from Maldon Island, which was 200 miles away, because of the band of bomb, you know, Aldermass and all that, to move the dropping zone to 30 miles off Christmas Island. So we could only be 30 miles at maximum from the H-bomb ground zero.
Have you or people you know suffered long-term health effects?
I was blind within 2 years of the bomb in my right eye. I've got ankylosing spondylosis of the spine, and I've now only got 30% kidney function.
And you think this is all because of the testing?
I'm positive of it.
What would you like the government to do now, then?
Just come clean.
Peter Walker reporting. Guardian Daily was produced today by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.